The following Dharma talk was given at Common Ground Meditation Center in Minneapolis, Minnesota. The speaker is Mark Nunberg, guiding teacher at Common Ground.
Tonight is our last class, week 7 of this 7-week class on compassion and loving kindness. And I believe the sign up for the summer class is set up online. So you can go ahead and register for the class, The Hindrances, which begins, I think, at the very end of June. I think that also might be 7 weeks. And I'll send out to people on the list some books. There's a book by Gil Fronsdahl that some of you might want to get on the hindrances, and also one by Ajahn Tirodamo. So we have some really great books besides some wonderful articles. But in case people want to do a little reading ahead of time. And I'll also announce right now, as long as I'm mentioning the schedule, that, of course, we'll have our June Community Practice Intensive beginning a week later than usual. So I forget the exact date, but it's around the 10th of June, that Monday. And goes for 2.5 weeks. So think if you want to join some community members to increase your practice for that period of time. It's really a nice way to complement daily sitting practice and maybe periodic retreat practice by increasing the intensity of your formal practice in the context of your daily life and other responsibilities that you have. So I thought for this last class that we'd look together at this experience of boundlessness, or the immeasurable quality. And remember, in the tradition, those of you who've been reading Venerable Anālio's book, Compassion and Emptiness in Early Buddhist Meditation, he mentions how in the early discourses that the four Brahma-viharas of loving-kindness, compassion, appreciative joy, and equanimity map on or sometimes used synonymously with the four jhanas, which is interesting. But one, you can get that sense with these qualities. They have a resonant aspect to them, meaning it's a natural landing or abiding place for the mind when the sense of friendliness, the sense of compassion, the sense of appreciative joy, or equanimity, when that's present in the mind, it's in the nature of the mind to abide there. There's a certain way the mind lands and abides or is held in that particular quality of those four aspects of love. And the point in the guided meditation tonight is to really, I try to at least, emphasize that when there's a more mature sense of love, compassion, joy, equanimity, it has a space-like quality. In a way, we could say its quality is more that space that of the absence of ill will. Not what's there, but what's not there. So I thought I'd take a little time before launching into some teachings that might, for some of you at least, seem a little out there, or I don't know, maybe not out there, but not that helpful. Just to have people report their own, from tonight, but also your home practice, like how those words that are used in the tradition, like the immeasurable quality, the boundless quality, the expansive quality in reference to love, what does that feel, look like? How do you experience that in your sits, in your daily life? The space-like quality. Or emptiness, too, right? The mind is empty of divisions or empty of separation, empty of feeling alienated, empty of ill will, empty of fear. So what's that like? So let's just take a few moments, maybe hear from 5 people, if there are that many people who want to share, or even ask an initial question. I'll try to save time at the end for some questions as well. But just some thoughts about your experience in meditation and the experience of boundlessness. Anything come to mind? Not to put anybody on the spot. Yeah. Ben.
In my sitting... Is it on?
I think it's on.
Okay. In my sitting practice, the sensation of boundlessness often feels like I'm falling into a body of water, and it feels very supportive and self-sustaining. So there, you know, oftentimes in a sit, I'll feel physical pain or mental pain or, you know, some sort of emotional pain, and there will be a moment when I fall out of that, and it feels very, very comforting. And it reminds me of times in my daily life where I'll be thinking of a problem or some frustration that I'm having, usually with somebody else, either with, you know, my family or my friends or at work. And there's usually a sense in a similar way where I fall away from that, the hardness of the disagreement or the conflict. And the boundlessness feels just very infinite in terms of that I could stay there for a long time if only I could hold it. And also that it feels, when there's a conflict or when there's pain, it feels very, very much like I'm in some sort of room where it's, you know, I can see the boundaries of where I am. But you know, when I fall out of that, it feels very infinite in a very almost physical sense, which is kind of odd to say.
Yeah, that's helpful, Ben. Thanks. Yeah, so how we verbalize it, of course, will be different. But more than the words people speak, just kind of let it be almost like they're painting a picture or giving us a flavor, right? And there's this thing in research, I'm sure some of you know, of triangulation. We hear different voices talk about it, and we get it will activate our own understanding. And one more thing that just for whatever reason came to mind when Ben was talking is it's not something we create. We don't, because that's what it seems like, we're sort of revving up the experience of love. You know, using the phrase, using the image, maybe using the heart center as a location for the attention. We're kind of like, you know, starting this thing up, getting it and giving it some momentum. But it's... when it is strong and you feel like you have a pretty clear sense of it, you can even ask yourself, am I creating this? Am I doing this? Or is this state of mind, quality of mind, attitude of mind, is this just the way it is? So that can help. Because that really shifts how our confidence can support it. Like if there's a sense of that space always available, we can't necessarily access it because of the seductiveness of our dramas, but there's a deepening confidence that it's there. Thanks again, Ben. Someone else? Yeah, Ryan, please.
When you ask that question, you know, what that experience is like, I think one of the experience of boundlessness, one word that came to mind was receiving, this profound receiving quality, like everything that the mind is knowing or detecting is coming towards it. So there's a really strong directional sense, like the mind doesn't have to do anything to know anything. It's on the receiving end of everything. And there's a kind of, I guess the word is sort of an equanimous quality to whatever it's knowing, so that it's aware of the differences, or the distinctions between what it's knowing, but it's not so concerned with the differences between them. It's just aware that, I guess, it's knowing.
Yeah. some of the ways they talk about what I think you were talking about, Ryan, is this, you know, the reality of differentiation, the mind that discriminates, the mind that sees the different objects. It's not like that mind goes away, but the relevance of distinctions goes away. So, you know, that feeling of unification or wholeness or non-division, it doesn't mean that somehow the mind no longer comprehends difference. It's just less relevant or not relevant. Because what's relevant is that everything is included in the space of, you know, what we are, at least in this class, calling love. But we don't want to get confused by the word, because it can seem like somebody who's loving. And so feel free to use a different word or no word. Who's next? Thanks, Ryan.
Yeah, for me it was interesting. I noticed the sense of self really diminishing and almost dissolving in the space. Conceit is...
Maybe a little closer.
Yep, sorry. Dissolves, and then it almost passes through, and you can sort of see and try and grasp at the experience, then that sense of kind of being the expansiveness sort of collapses and almost goes away. So there's this very sort of it's hard to describe. It's almost like more like a field or a wave of expansion. Yeah. And then the sense of that sense of I am, it's hard to describe, just fades.
Yeah. Poets talk about this a lot, right? I was thinking today earlier of this line from Rumi's poem. I couldn't find the poem. I looked online. I have it written down somewhere, but I don't know where. But one of the lines in this poem by Rumi is, as it's translated at least, from lover to love. And different poets talk about the same thing, right? There's a whole type of poetry and really a religious, spiritual practice, devotional practice of this merging with the beloved, with God or whatever that might be, you know, where we might start at sort of fixated on being the lover or, you know, devoted to the object of our love. But at some point, it's just love, right? The sense of somebody who loves or somebody who's so appreciative of God's love goes away and there's just love. And that's really the meditative experience, as you described, is we might initially use a very dualistic thing like I love my cat at home and I think about my cat and think about how much joy there is in taking care of my cat or whatever your child, your whatever the story that we bring to mind. But if we're given good instruction, if we practice well, that the duality of the story falls away and love is what remains. The experience is what we're interested in. In that experience, the sense of self in any particular form isn't relevant. Without anybody trying to get rid of that sense of self, it just, like you say, it just evaporates or fades away or disappears. It becomes irrelevant because something has become relevant.
For my sits and in my day-to-day life, I just found this experience of boundlessness to be really comforting. And also, I just found that it makes everything so much easier when you can hold it. I just find that I just get really worked up about injustices in the world, and I can just see how much reactivity I have around that and the tendency towards anger, even frustration, ill will. And when I get in those experiences or even come to sit and those experiences are coming up in my head and those frustrations are coming up in my head, if I can just get that little bit of space and let go of ill will, it's just like such a relief and a release. And I just really resonate with other people, what we've been discussing, just about having that perspective to kind of see things from outside yourself, or the sense of selflessness. It's like it comes in snippets, or just like really quick flashes, kind of, or just for short periods of time, but just to like catch that glimmer, or that like just that moment of like disconnecting from the frustration or in the emotional charge, any ill will that comes up, is like, then it's just easy. It's so much easier, and it's so like, it's way more comfortable in my, just being in my body and engaging. So yeah, that's been my experience.
Yeah, little cracks, those little glimpses, then even when the mind, because of the gravitational pull of habit energy to be self-righteous or to be angry or to be whatever, even though the mind gets pulled back in, there's more porousness in the oppressive force of our dramas or our anger or dualistic thinking. It's still there, still sort of acting itself out in predictable ways, but it's gradually held lighter in a more light way, more porous way. Because every time we have that little glimmer, the mind, it's like the mind collects one more data point that the framing, that ill will, let's just use ill will as an example, the framing that ill will brings to life, you know, constructs a reality, the mind understands that that's something that happens, that's something that's constructed, that arises and ceases. It's not the truth. It may be a very persistent appearance, but it's not the truth. And even before we're consciously aware that these insights, this transformation is underfoot, it's underfoot. By the time it kind of rocks our world, the insight, that means we've been collecting that data, that seeing little glimpses for a long time, but not believing it, not sort of really knowing what's going on, until there's enough data that the mind can't not know that it isn't what it appears to be. The ill will, the fear that so often structures, you know, sort of the glue of our mental constructions, our self-centered dramas, it's like they're still there, but the oppressive weight of them, it's not the same. Yeah, thanks, Claire. Maybe time for one more person. Anybody else want to share with the group? Yeah, please, Sandy.
For me, it's been like, and I'm not sure if it's because I've been like tight for a long time, but it's like I can only describe it as that, like after a really good cry, that first really deep breath you take, and mm-hmm. just kind of that release, and I don't know if that is just the only way I can describe it, or like the smell of somebody coming in from outside. Like I read that line in a book.
Great images.
I read that in a book by my favorite author, but it's this mother and her son, and she grabs him and she smells him and she says, "You smell like outside," and it's that.
Yeah. Yeah, there's that distinct smell, and I think we all resonated with that other image of that breath after a good cry. And I think what you're pointing to is there's a sense of weight and intuiting its release. And I think that's, both of those images point to that. Like there was some being bound up by emotional energy, and then the cry releases that. And then at some point, energetically in the body, there's a realization that there was a weight and it's not there anymore. And it's surprising, right? And I think it's similar to that smell of outside. I mean, as I've experienced, I get it with the cat. You know, when you smell the cat after it's been out all day, it smells like outside, laundry does too, that's been hung on the line, you know, or when you're with your sweetie, you know, and you've been outside and you get a hug or something, it's like there's that smell of outside. And it's different than, we didn't realize how oppressive being inside is, but when we smell the outside, it's sort of the fragrance of not being inside, not being in the bounds of our, I mean, these structures, like as nice as they are and as much as we probably don't want to lose them, the fact is they're sort of a reflection of a lot of unhealthy stuff in our mind, you know, fear, like, so I'll build myself a box, you know, messiness, I'll make the box have right angles in a way that nothing out there really in the world does, right? But we can make it really orderly, and it gets oppressive. Did somebody have their hand up over here? Do you want to? Great, Elizabeth.
So I was actually going to say something somewhat similar in that the feeling is like right before you cry, like that moment where you realize you can't hold it in anymore. And it's just that, like, it's all falling away. And I think also when for me, it's the feeling of holding one of my daughters. And it's just that overwhelming feeling of just reverence. Like, I just can't believe this thing exists. And kind of wanting to hold it, but not wanting to harm it, and wanting to just observe it and stand back and be so appreciative of it, but also wanting to grab it at the same time. And it's just that sort of tension between those things. I mean, the other thing too that kind of comes to mind is, like, if you find like a bird that's been hurt, or like a small baby animal, and you want to pick it up, but you don't want to hurt it more. And so you're kind of trying to hold it in your hand. And there's just this feeling of, like, of awe and adoration for this thing that's so fragile and beautiful. You want to grasp it, but you also just want to kind of stand back. And there's just this feeling of, I guess, of awe and adoration that kind of comes over you.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, that's helpful. And I bet a lot of you have had a related experience to some of what you were just talking about, where in a sit or just in daily life, and there is more of that movement, that expansive movement of joy and rapture, which is often related to the practices of the Brahma Viharas, the divine abodes. And it's interesting because with that expansive movement of joy, something opening up, there can be something that arises to meet that in a fear, like, oh, this is too much, I don't trust this. And it can be an interesting place, and it can even feel like something's going to break, and something actually does break. There's a story Jack Kornfield tells of a doctor who was on a retreat with him, and he was having really severe pain in his heart. He thought he was having a heart attack, and he thought he would tell Jack before he went off to the hospital. And, you know, he had maybe some kind of intuition that, I'm not really sure, but it sure feels like a heart attack. And it was a heart attack, but not the kind he thought it was. I mean, it was just something that wasn't used to moving was moving, but there was a lot of habit energy around not trusting things being open and moving and unconfined, unrestricted. And so you might notice that sometimes, like even tonight, for example, in my own practice, and this is not uncommon, you know, when I'm on purpose contemplating that expansive feeling, which is generally a go-to place in meditation if it's accessible, whether it has the particular flavor of love or the flavor of peace, right? And always, what the more that the mind, the heart, is invited to abide there, the more that anything that for whatever reason, is bound up, not able to be included in that open state, it really stands out. So the places that are being held, emotionally, physically, energetically, psychically, spiritually, whatever, they stand out. They're really highlighted. So it can be an intense place. And we're not using that state of openness or expansion or the quality of love. There can be just a noticing the contrast, noticing the edge, and sort of trusting the nature to loosen things up or to have its effect without, you know, wanting to do demolition or breakthrough, have a breakthrough moment, which is, you can imagine, counterproductive. Thanks for all the great sharings, everyone. I do want to share a few things and also save a little time at the end for more sharings and any questions that people might have. And I'm sorry if I read this earlier in the course, but I just want to bring it up again in terms of here it is. This is from Venerable Anallio's book, page 58. He says, the mental experience of boundlessness is by its very nature free from any strain or tension, and thereby offers a natural way into deepening mental tranquility. Moreover, the very fact that one is engaging in compassion, etc., makes it almost inevitable that one will be soft with oneself instead of pushing too hard. Besides encouraging a soft and allowing attitude towards oneself, the mental attitude engendered by the Brahmaviharas will also be of considerable assistance when one has to face external disturbances or even internal disturbances. He goes on writing, instead of resulting in the frustrating experience of wavering between being concentrated on the chosen object of meditation and having lost this object due to external sounds or other disturbances, meditation can continue smoothly. This can be achieved by making the sound or disturbance part of the practice. Compassion informs one's attitude towards the disturbance or those responsible for it. In this way, problems can become the path, even though the degree of mental tranquility will not be as profound as it would have been without the disturbance, the actual practice continues seamlessly. In this way, the main concern of one's practice would not be the reaching of a particular mark in concentrative depth, but the maintenance of the boundless radiation of the Brahmaviharas when facing any disturbance. Any disturbance, including any form of mental distraction, thus simply becomes food for the practice. And then this is the place, now I'm on page 59, where he makes that point about the similarities and the overlap in terms of how the Buddha spoke between the four Brahmaviharas and the jhanas, these deep states of meditative absorption. And he really, in that quote, he really points to the point I was making before, that when there is some degree of opening and the mind, the heart abiding more fully, trusting more fully this space that's empty of ill will, right? Really trusting the unboundedness of that space, and then that intention to abide, to relax there, to trust it, to appreciate it, is then in conflict with some unfinished business. You know, like, she did this to me. I mean, but it may not even be a formed problem in your life, but just it feels like something's being held or a place that's energetically tight, right? So then this gives us our instruction. So instead of, you know, trying to break through, it's really that line from Joko Beck, a bigger container, like realizing that this space, this boundless space, is already including that. It's not like a competition between the boundlessness in the knot, in the hardness, but that the hardness already is included in the space. So it's a kind of a special move that's really a confidence move, a confidence in the nature of the mind or in the nature of goodness. That it isn't something we constructed that's in competition with other things that have been constructed or set in motion, and now it's a question of who's bigger. It's more the move that sort of allows for the continued expansion is realizing that one is essential. One is, in a sense, the nature of the mind, or is reflective of the nature of the mind. And the other thing is a construction that arose in the nature of the mind, in the space of the mind. And so it can be included. And you see how that has everything to do with love. I mean, that's what love is. It's what can show up. It's what knows how to, you know, in a practical, ordinary sense, what knows how to show up to whatever the situation is in our life. That's why there are these four flavors, because joy is what we use to show up when something beautiful is going on, and compassion is what we use to get close, to be intimate when there's some suffering, and equanimity when it's ambiguous, right? And it's all, they all have the flavor of friendliness, gentleness, inclusivity. And this is, you know, we have our resistance because of the pain that we feel and the unpleasantness of the pain that we feel, emotional pain, psychic pain. We have doubts that it's almost like maybe it's related to cognitive dissonance, because in ways we're so invested in our suffering and being a suffering being. Remember the line from Buddhaghosa in the Path of Purification, the Visuddhimagga, this ancient text, where he says, suffering is, but no sufferer can be found. So we have, you know, we've spent so many moments investing, identifying with suffering, that it's this experience, you know, of a boundless state, moments of that, glimpses of that. It might be hard for us to trust it. There's a line, there's a great Jungian person, Robert Johnson. He has, a short but a wonderful book on the shadow, how it plays out in spiritual life, that I read a while back, but I really found it useful, because there's always shadow. There's shadow in how we practice here. It's not like Buddhism is immune to shadows. And I'm not sure if this is from that book, but he writes here, this is, I think, from Jack Kornfield's book, he has a quote from Robert Johnson. Curiously, people resist the noble aspects of their shadow more strenuously than they hide their dark sides. It is more disrupting to find that you have a profound nobility of character than to find out that you are a bum. So I think in maybe more spiritual terms, you know, or in the sort of underlying nature of the mind, because we have so much investment and so much of our early practice is just seeing the defilements, seeing the hardness, seeing the negativity, that it's really interesting to experience those expanded states. I remember once when I accessed a sort of a more profound state of quiet, but a really beautiful expanded state, I just cried. And it was exactly that. It was like even though I knew a lot about the practice at that point, but there's so much emotional therapeutic healing in that moment to see something that is just inherent in the nature of the mind. It's so contradicted all of that ancient programming that I'm not good enough, you know, trying to be a good meditator to sort of prove myself to myself and to others, or you know, try to be funny or whatever, all those things that we try to be. And to, you know, experience something that is so indisputably wholesome and good, it really interrupts. It's a profound challenge to any sense of shame or not being good enough. So we want to be on the lookout of pushback as your practice in the Brahmaviharas, the loving kindness practices, as it naturally, as they naturally develop, and you touch and you trust, then there's going to be something that has a problem with that, right? Like all of our confidence in not being good enough, or even more like thinking we have a lot of work to do, right? Even that thought, because it's not quite right. I mean, on a certain level, there may be a lot of work to do, but that doesn't that in no way dismisses or denies the underlying nature of love or the underlying open, empty nature of the mind itself, empty of the defilements. Some of you know Nagarjuna. He's a well-known character in the Buddhist tradition several hundred years after the time of the Buddha. And actually, a lot of different traditions claim him. Often he's thought of as one of the real Mahayana Buddhist saints. But, you know, when you read his writings, it's really in line with how the Buddha taught. And so now there's more recently, you know, a reclaiming by the Theravada tradition of Nagarjuna. Let's see if I can find it. And this is, I think, a really good book written by Stephen Batchelor called, here it is, Verses from the Center. And it's just his translations and commentary on some of Nagarjuna's writing. I can't remember right now what century, maybe like 2nd century, somewhere in there, CE. So, you know, 600 to 900 years after the time of the Buddha. So this is Stephen Batchelor writing, and then he'll quote some of Nagarjuna's verses. The inspiration of the sublime selflessness of the natural world enables one to see the pettiness of one's self-centered fantasies. Yet at the heart of this spacious stillness, one discovers that one is not alone, but intimately interwoven into a seamless web of sentient life, which one compares to a vast organism. And so these are some verses. Just as these arms and legs are seen as limbs of a body, why are embodied creatures not seen as limbs of life? And this is just part of that, you know, part of the effect of developing Brahmaviharas and other expanded states is the mind begins to sense that the different boundaries that we're invested in are constructions. And I remember this was like a really sort of lightning and thunder experience of rapture once, when I was reading a book, and it was kind of this quirky book that evidently, I mean, I don't know what to think about people who say they're channeling somebody, but I keep an open mind because I don't know. So this was a person who was channeling somebody, and this person was telling this person, or this supposed being was telling this person about the sort of structure of the universe. And what this disembodied being was saying was that this, like, we think of my body as being, you know, here, this is me, and we make a big deal of like where my skin is and what's inside and what's outside of that. But he just sort of laid out the whole thing as just different levels of organization as you might have in a big corporation. You know, you've got one office here with three people, and then that head of that office reports. And so this is how it goes, you know, like on a molecular level, reporting to maybe a collection of molecules, and maybe reporting eventually to the cellular level, to the organ level, to the maybe whole body level, to the clan level, to the, you know, ethnic level or species level at some point, to Gaia, you know, the earth level, to the solar bureaucrat, you know, in charge of the solar system, galactic, and then on and on like that. So I was just reading this and just contemplating this idea, you know, that just the idea that the frames that my mind used unconsciously, and it's just opened up. And it was like explosions. I mean, I thought, I didn't know what was happening. There was just like a lot of energy moving. And it's just rapture. It's just because the idea, like people mentioned here, we don't realize how much oppression there is with the frames we just unconsciously live with. And when they get loosened up even a little bit, a lot of energy just starts to move. Like just a little kink in the idea that this particular framing is just a convention that the mind is in a deep habit with, but it's just a convention. And we could just as easily be imagining ourselves as a sentient cell in some solar being, some Gaia being, some species being, some, you know, family being, right? And sometimes we sort of think with a family mind, and sometimes we think in a mammal way, right? We're just sort of, it's my mammalian, is that how you say it? Programming, right? Or maybe we need to, at least these days, think from a more earth level, Gaia mind, like, okay, how healthy are we? What needs to be done here? Let me just read a little bit more here. Just as the hand reaches out to soothe the pain in the foot, why does one not spontaneously respond to the suffering of another in the same way? Shantideva realizes that this is due to a deep visceral clinging to the idea of being a separate self. As long as one is in thrall of this fixation, spontaneous concern for others will tend to be felt only for those who fall within the range of what is mine. And you mentioned, you know, like seeing a little creature. It's relatively easy for us to sort of say that's mine. And it's interesting, like I was doing some research last week before the talk because I wanted to find out a little bit more. Some of you know about this gorilla. Was it Coco? Anybody remember the name? It was famous. Yeah, and they gave this mountain gorilla, so one of the big gorillas, kittens. And he had a very seemingly affectionate, loving relationship, interspecies love, really. And then the cat, you know, could get in and out of the cage and I guess got hit by a car and got killed. And the woman who was a friend of this gorilla and also one of the trainers or whatever they called themselves, researchers maybe, told, because this gorilla knew sign language, you know, that the kitten had died and then was grieving. First, it didn't grieve at first. He signaled something like, you know, that's not good, that's not okay. And then later when they left him, they had a camera and a microphone, and just wailing, I mean, just in the way that the gorillas wail, you know, grieving. So it's just interesting, like these boundaries that we think are there, they're constructions. And, you know, there are reasons we have these constructions because we don't, like I was saying earlier, trust boundarylessness. We don't trust how much energy there would be if we cared about everybody. Like, we may not want to care about Donald Trump. It might be easier for people who have trouble with that president or another politician or some sibling that you had a falling out with 20 years ago or a neighbor who you think is not behaving appropriately. Like, we're invested in these divisions. And we're afraid, we don't know who we would be. We're so used to the box, the oppressive box that we're in. We don't know who we'd be outside of that. The pain of those outside of this range can then be treated with indifference and even satisfaction. Shantideva refines Nagarjuna's vision by spelling out the effective and ethical implications of emptiness. Emptiness not only eases, so emptiness of self, emptiness of ill will, right? Emptiness not only eases the cognitive restriction of self-centeredness, it generates feelings of empathy. When Shantideva dissolved his sense of being a closed cell of self, he did not vanish into an abyss of nothingness. Instead, he rediscovered himself as a cell that formed part of the interdependent multicellular organism of existence itself. He realized that his sense of being Shantideva was not grounded in an isolated personal essence hidden deep within himself somewhere, but was created out of his myriad and unrepeatable relationship with others. I'm going to skip a little. Emptiness is counterintuitive because it contradicts the deepest sense a person has of being me. Yet as Shantideva makes clear, emptiness does not eliminate this me, but transforms it. Contrary to expectation, an empty self turns out to be a relational self, right? And I'll just end before opening it up this very famous passage from Shantideva's treatise called The Way of the Bodhisattva. And you really get a sense of how alive a person can be when they're not trapped in the constructions of the mind, the sort of conventional self-centered mind. May I be a guard for those who are protectorless, a guide for those who journey on the road. For those who wish to go across the water, may I be a boat, a raft, a bridge. May I be an isle for those who yearn for landfall, and a lamp for those who long for light. For those who need a resting place, a bed. And for all who need a servant, may I be their slave. May I be a wishing jewel, the vase of plenty, a word of power, and the supreme healing. May I be a tree of miracles, and for every being, the abundant cow, like the earth and the pervading elements, enduring as the sky itself endures, for boundless multitudes of living beings, may I be their ground and sustenance. Thus, for everything that lives, as far as the limits of the sky, may I provide their livelihood and nourishment until they pass beyond the bonds of suffering. It's a lot more I can say, but it might be nice for the last 11 minutes or so to just see your responses from some of what I've shared, or just any questions that you have, or just continuing the discussion of experience of being relatively in a relatively expanded state, and in contrast to the, you know, more regular, ordinary, constricted states. Yeah, Tim, who has the mic? Oh, there it is.
Thank you, Mark. Since starting this class, how about now?
You just have a quiet voice, Tim.
Since starting the class, I found that my concentration has improved a lot, and it is based on that, on the book by Analio that I read before the class started, and I kind of saw how these two mind states were kind of linked, and I find I'm able to control my thoughts a lot more than I used to be. And it makes me feel kind of, it gives me this kind of like empowered feeling that I don't have to keep going down the same pathways over and over. and in my meditation I've felt very focused, but it also feels like I'm making efforts to stay focused, and it's effort I want to make because I'm working on meditating without thoughts and seeing how long I can go without thinking, because that's just where I'm being drawn right now. And but today during the guided meditation, it seemed a lot more effortless, and I was just wondering, like, is there any place, what is the place of effort in the framework that Analeo describes?
Yeah, I think the effort is, you know, initially there needs to be, let's just say, a personal effort, but only as a counterweight to the force of habit. But once the mind has gone beyond the gravitational pull of habit, so it's tuned in to something that's beyond habit, habit's still operating, but there's something bigger in the space, right? Then the practice is more about trusting that new gravitational pull, or, you know, like that quality of expansion, keeping it in mind, not forgetting it. You don't need a personal effort to bring the attention back or to name or to notice being caught. But if we don't, so it's always good to check, because especially if you're practicing regularly and if you're in a place where you have some momentum, you might not need to make that kind of more gross level effort, even though you're right at the beginning of your sitting period. Your mind may be ready to abide. And it can be counterproductive when your mind is ready to abide to be efforting in a more normal sense of the word. And that's the thing about effort. Effort is always relative to the way the mind is in that moment. And we are efforting, our way of efforting has to be as nimble or as varied as there are states of mind, you know, and there are every, you know, from a really gross mind that's completely overwhelmed by negativity to a very refined, expansive mind. The effort is different all the way along that spectrum, right? And so at the most refined state, there's no effort at all, right? The effort is, if any effort would be to recognize when neurotic effort arises, you know, and to immediately see that that's not needed. It's not necessary. You can relax. Yeah, thanks, Tim, for bringing that up. Other thoughts? Yeah, hiya.
I got it. Too late. I'll fight you for it. No. And I'm in an expanded state, so I'm strong. No. A couple of things. I've noticed a lot of, like, glittering behind my eyes a lot. And I associate it with subtle body awareness while I'm moving through life. And it's very much as though I've been joined by something that's not exactly me. She's very loving to me. And I was using Thich Nhat Hanh's words, which were, "Dear one, I'm here for you," but it flipped. And I started saying, "Dear one, I'm here for you." And I started to realize how much I loved this awareness that was moving with me, and how much deep affection I had for this lived thing. And the only other thing I'll say is, I have this client who has Pick's disease. It's a terrible disease. I hope no one else gets it. But I like to go in expanded states with him because I can reach him. So, like, the other day he was on his bed, and you have to really get in his face to get him out. And I was staring at him, and I think we stared at each other without looking away for about 20 minutes. It was more than we do in life. It was more than we do in theater, you know, where we're just ogling the landscape of another being. And we both went, like, his face just started breaking up into other faces, shadows, like when you stare at anything. But I swear we merged or something. And so it was an expanded state where I felt as though I was giving him, reaching him with presence, that you couldn't reach him with language. You can barely reach him with touch, but something happened between us. I don't know. So expanded states are actually just the beginning. They're just a tool of something else that we live in boxes. That's the one thing I realized after I did this with Stephen, that it's like we live like this. It's so small how we live. I'm here, you're there. We do this, I do that. It's ridiculous. Who wanted this?
Thank you, Anne, for her manifesto. Sounds right.
Now the real Haya speaks. You know, it seems like this is something I've been, you know, compassion, loving kindness, appreciative joy, equanimity. It's like so focused in for a while. And I don't know if this is, you know, right for everybody, but for me what I found is when I finally was able to become abiding and seeing the abundance was when I started to have compassion for myself, have loving kindness for myself. Then there was room to open it up to all beings. And it's amazing how, I know it has become a habit and I'm not sure why, but there's just something that just, my hand just goes right to my heart when I'm feeling things that are, you know, or I'm in this one class and there's a woman that, I don't really want to describe something, but somewhat on the spectrum, whatever that means. But I could just feel how difficult it was for her to try in this class to try to explain what she wanted to say. And I'm thinking, I have that same difficulty too. You know, there's times where I can't say what I want to say. I'm not different than others. And there was so long of a period of my life where I was like, you know, I don't belong. I don't, you know, so now I'm not, there's no longer this single being anymore. I feel like I'm part of this wholeness. And so, but it felt like it started with being okay with who this heart was. And then it was able to expand.
Yeah. Thanks, Haya. It's beautiful. And I think we have to leave it there. It's 9:00. So why don't we just take a few moments of silence together. Let go of the words. Appreciate how wholesome our time together these 7 weeks has been. We can allow there to be a natural sadness, perhaps, or whatever that feels like, to be ending tonight. Wishing each other well in our practice, in our lives. May we meet again as Dharma friends, fellow practitioners on this ancient path, grateful for our lineage of wise women, men, folks before us who did their practice. And now it's our turn to develop wisdom and compassion, to be wise, skillful beings, to share and to contribute. So may this be so.
This talk, like all programs at Common Ground, is offered freely in the spirit of generosity. To learn more about Common Ground and its programs, or if you would like to donate, please visit our website, www.commongroundmeditation.org.